let's talk. So when I the an email kind of went out when Domio was planning to go on sabbatical, and we're, asking if anybody wanted to sign up for these. And I was like, oh yeah, I'll do one. And on the signup sheet, you put like your name, and then there was like a little column for like what you're going to talk about. And I was like, oh, I don't know yet. And so I put my name down, and I left that column blank. And I was like, oh, I'll come back to it tomorrow. And I did not come back to it the next day. And it took a while. And so I picked eventually what our topic is going to be, which is transformation or change in practice. Mostly because I don't know what else I would do. And what I want everybody to kind of think about is like, this is something that I have no idea what I'm talking about. I'm hoping that maybe like all of us together can piece something like make some kind of sense out of it. But I don't know. I'm just going to give it a shot. And so what I want us to kind of start with is to try to think about ways in which Zen practice has changed us or transformed us. And one of the things that we're going to go to breakout rooms in a minute. One of the things I want us to really think about when we're in those breakout rooms is not just necessarily the changes that practice has brought you, or maybe that you hope practice might bring you, but also kind of like how that change happens, how that transformation works. In Zen, and what exactly is it that kind of nudges you to make that change? I'll give like a really simple example in my own practice. It was probably the first precept study group that I was in when I took the precepts, I think, which was 3 years ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago. I became a vegetarian, and I, not necessarily for like, I don't know, I don't think I'm saving any animals, I don't think I'm doing anything grand, but it was really the precept on not stealing. We got into this discussion of gifts that are freely given, gifts that are genuine gifts. And I remember thinking that this consuming an animal, especially if it's raised just to be consumed, that's a gift that is not freely given to me. And I just sort of like decided I don't want to take that if it's not going to be freely given. And it was pretty easy for me personally just to kind of give it up. It was almost weird. It didn't take a lot of conscious effort. I didn't really feel tempted by like meat afterwards. It is difficult, like logistically. I live in North Carolina, which is like we love our barbecue here in North Carolina, and so I've been to restaurants where I eat like a side salad. It's part of my family. My family is necessarily like almost all vegetarian just because I don't want to make two meals. My wife doesn't want to make two meals. When my kids go to visit their grandparents, they'll eat like actual beef hamburgers that we like literally we have Impossible meat burgers. And so we'll eat over there at grandma's house, and they're like, these burgers are delicious. They're the greatest things I've ever eaten. They've only really treated Impossible. And I feel like the way that change happened for me was that I just kind of was able to clearly take stock in what was happening. And then also I had sort of like an answer, a vow that I took that I felt compelled to fulfill. And I think that's really some of the power of vow in practice that I've really enjoyed. And I think that, like, that specifically is really what helped me make that change. I don't think I'm like a better person or like closer to being a Buddha because of it, but I feel like I'm living my life more intentionally now than I was. And I've got a couple other like positive transformations that I think I've made through practice. And so what I'd like to try in for about the next maybe 10 minutes is we'll get into groups of maybe three or four, and we can talk about, and in those groups, you can talk about a transformation or a change that practice has helped you make. And I really want you to try to like think about what about the practice really kind of pushed you into that change. And if you're new to practice or if you're not sure, you can pick something. I don't know if you have a list. I have a list of things I would like to turn into because of practice too. So you can think about something that you might like to envision yourself being after some time of practice. So if it's all right, Tyler, let's try to get breakout groups of three or four, and then maybe three groups in the Dirt Zendo. And we'll take, maybe about 10 or 12 minutes. And then we'll say 12. I want to give people enough time to talk. And then we'll come back. Okay, does anybody want to share or talk about what they had discussed or just kind of like share with the group? I think it's really helpful for us to do that, just to kind of like get others' perspectives. I like to think of what we're doing tonight is like everybody's trying to put a puzzle together, and it's good to kind of know where other people are at or what other people have found. So does anybody want to just take a minute to share what they had said?
So we had kind of some amount of awareness. Things that came up for us were being more aware of ourselves, paying more attention to what's going on inside of us, and making choices about responding versus reacting. The other thing that came up was there were a number of places where we were doing different. We were doing different things after we were doing practice that we wouldn't have done before, that we might have rolled our eyes at. What? You do that? So I think that's kind of a quick summary of what we talked about.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Somebody in our group had mentioned having like a heightened awareness even in the moment, like, because it's kind of easy to sit in your dark room and meditate and think about, you know, I shouldn't have approached it that way. But to have that kind of awareness in your day-to-day life, I think it's definitely been a change maybe that a lot of us had experienced in practice. Anybody in the Dirt Zendo want to give it a shot? Brave enough to sit in the chair? All right. Oh, yeah. Great. And then Tyler, you'll go next.
Oh, it's great. Hi.
Hi.
I'm Yoli. And we had a variety of different things in our group. Some of the things that we discussed was being nicer to people. Zen makes you nicer. Jeff, I forgot what you had said.
Or just the value of sitting.
Oh, the value of sitting.
Yeah.
For me, I think in particular, I have ADHD and I find myself wasting a lot of time. And one of the, you know, I'm either hyper-focused or I'm completely not focused. And one of the things I have come to value about Buddhism is the being in the present moment and really, you know, valuing everything about a day, a minute, a moment in your life. And when I waste time, I'm not really in that moment. And so I want to be able to, and I've gotten better, but I'm not there yet. And it's something to aspire to. And I just really want to know that I am valuing every moment of every day and I'm not wasting it. Sometimes it's okay to waste it, but I want to be just more present. And I think that's the most important thing.
Thank you, Yoni. Tyler.
Yeah, just no one else was diving in, so I thought I'd extend a little bit on what I talked to in my group. And that was just that, and some people have probably heard this story because I don't have so many that I tell here, only have so many, but when I, prior to me being in finding this community and finding this this spiritual path, I was completely like, wasn't brought up spiritual. I wasn't part of any religion, any formal anything. It just wasn't a part of my life. And so to see this, what I saw is like a massive transformation of being like completely secular to doing things like wanting to set up an altar and having that altar be meaningful and like wanting a space in my house that had a little statue on it and had some water, and then would walk by, I could just like just take a second and give a bow. And I put one out in my garden so it could look over my garden. I give it incense. I'm not entirely sure why I'm giving it incense, but I'm giving it, and it's like these things have become important to me. And these are what Jim already spoke about. Like prior, I might have rolled my eyes if I saw someone out in their garden giving like offering to a statue. I'd been like, okay, sure. Like, but so that to me was just like a big transformation in how I understood spirituality and just how I experienced it myself. So that was a big one for me.
Yeah, that's funny what you mentioned about the altar. When I started my practice, I kind of like made a makeshift one out of like a filing cabinet that my wife and I had in our bedroom. And, you know, I put like a little silk thing over it. I put like I had this big cheesy jade, like Hote, you know, like the laughing Buddha. And I put it on there. And after a while, I asked my wife, I was like, oh, you don't mind me like having this stuff? And she was like, you'll you'll be done with that in like 2 months anyways. Like, it's fine. Like, it's a phase, you'll go through it. That was really funny. But yeah, like, I totally get that. I find myself like, really invested in the associated things with this practice. Well, I'm glad that we all have transformation and change on the mind, because what we're going to talk about this evening is exactly that. And I'm going to read a little, I might call it a fascicle or maybe even a talk that was given by Dogen back in the day. Dogen is the founder of Soto Zen, which is our lineage of Zen. I want to give everybody just a couple of background cultural references before we get into it, because he makes a couple of allusions to folklore that all of the monks that he was practicing with would have known. And the main thing that he's going to talk about is he's going to talk about this thing called a dragon gate. And in Chinese folklore, a dragon gate was a waterfall. And what happens is there was this story of, you would have fish swimming in a river, and the fish would swim up the waterfall. They would try to jump up it. And I don't know if you guys have seen the video of like salmon swimming upstream, and there's like bears. Well, this is what carp would do in the Yalu River in China. And so the carp would swim upstream, and they would see this. And there was this story in Chinese folklore that developed around it, and it was called the Dragon Gate. The Dragon Gate was a particular set of narrows in the Yalu River. And it was said that if a carp was strong enough and diligent enough, then that fish would pass through the Dragon Gate and it would be transformed into a dragon. It would no longer be a fish, it would be a mighty dragon through diligence and hard work. And so it was really a story about like the rewards of hard work. And it was commonly used in Chinese civil service exams. These were like exams for people to become civil servants, which would basically mean you are like socially and economically made. Like, you're like become the elite if you can pass your civil service exams. And people would study for these for years. So it's sort of a story about diligence and transformation, which is what we're talking about tonight. What I'm going to read from is called The Shobo Genzo Zui Monkey, which is roughly a collection of Dharma talks that Dogen gave to his Sangha, like when it was just starting out. He had an attendant, a Jisha named Ajo, who was his Dharma heir. And when they were practicing together, Ajo like diligently copied down Dharma talks that Dogen would give. His intent was never to have it published. And as a matter of fact, for about 200 years, nobody ever really published it. It just stayed at Aheiji in the monastery, but they were really for Ajo's personal use. He would study them, study what Dogen had said, go back over them. And sort of over the years, it has trickled down. And now it's a book, it's a collection of Dharma talks. They're very short. I'm not gonna read you the whole one from this one, but it's really only two pages. I think it's great reading. Because he's very straightforward. Dogen is like famously poetic and difficult, but his collection of works in the Zui Monkey are very straightforward. They're short, and the way some of them kind of like lodge themselves into your head really kind of helps. It's a fun way for me to practice. I've had this story about the Dragon Gate and another one that we might get to stuck in my head for 2 years, and they just kind of kick around in there. We'll get to it in a second, but I honestly don't know what he means here. And I want to see if we can get closer to figuring it out. So here's Dogen talking about the Dragon Gate. In the ocean, there's a place called the Dragon Gate. Here, waves constantly billow. Once they have passed through the waves at this place, all fish, without exception, become dragons. Therefore, this place is called the Dragon Gate. Now I say, at this place, the waves are not different from those in any other place, and the water is also ordinary salt water. However, mysteriously enough, when fish pass through this place, they become dragons without fail. Although their scales do not change and their bodies stay the same, they suddenly become dragons. We should know that the way of patch-robed monks is also like this. Although it is similar to other places, if we enter a monastery, without fail, we will become Buddhas and ancestors. We eat meals and wear clothes just like other people. We satisfy our hunger and ward off the cold just like other people. Still, if we simply shave our heads and reveal its roundness, wear a square robe, and eat gruel for breakfast and rice for lunch, we immediately become patch-robed monks. Becoming a Buddha or ancestor should not be sought elsewhere far away. Becoming a Buddha or ancestor depends only on whether or not we enter a monastery. Becoming a dragon depends only on whether a fish passed through the dragon gate. He goes on for a couple of other ones, and I want to mention a couple of things before I start to really kind of dive into this. He uses the phrase patch-robed monks a lot. So the patch-robed is referring to a rakusu, a square robe. Monastics, when they receive the precepts, they would sew a rakusu, they would sew their robes together, they patch together in the way of Buddha. So patch-robed monks is sort of what he's referring to there. He talks about entering a monastery. This was probably written in 1230, and the way to do serious practice at that time was to go into a monastery. I think for me personally, what he means when he says enter a monastery is he means enter serious practice. And I think that for a lot of us, we set aside this time. The sort of defining characteristic of the monastery is that you become a renunciate. You renounce earthly belongings, you renounce all of this stuff, and you become a monk. And I think that for us, when we come here together, and especially when we sit zazen, we are taking time in our modern lives to renounce all of that, all of the sort of the wealth, the socials, all of that stuff. We're renouncing it and we're coming together in practice. And so for me, I'm sitting in the sunroom of my house, but this is my monastery without walls. And I think that all of us, when we come together like this, we enter the Dragon Gate. What has stuck with me about this that I cannot understand is at the very beginning, he says, mysteriously enough, when fish pass through this place, they become dragons without fails. Although their scales do not change and their bodies stay the same, they suddenly become dragons. So he's saying that, like, you swim through the Dragon Gate, you go, you do wholehearted practice, and you don't look different, and your body stays the same. There's nothing that has changed. And so to me, and I think the biggest reason that this has stuck into my head is that he's saying that there's no real transformation that takes place. And so all of the things that we've talked about, all of this stuff, like how we're calmer and nicer and all of this stuff, I genuinely don't understand how I can square that, because my practice, and I think everybody's practice, has transformed me in real and significant ways, beneficial ways. How can I square that with what Dogen is telling me here? And I am not going to dismiss Dogen. This text has survived for around 800 years for a reason. There's got to be something in it. And I think maybe that's why it stuck out to me as well, is that it seems like there's something there. And one of the ways that practice kind of sticks with me is I read stuff like this. I mean, I read stuff like this a lot, but I just like breeze through it. I would probably read 3 or 4 of these a day. But what happens is some of them stick and you kind of hold them in your everyday existence. And I'm holding this story and I'm trying to understand what it means to remain a fish once I've passed through this dragon gate, I want to become something that I'm not. And I think that's what Dogen is pointing me to. The goal of practice is not to become something that you are not already. You are already here and you are already enough. And what I genuinely am struggling to understand is how do I square that with the genuine positive transformations that I've made in practice? What is happening if I'm enough, but tomorrow I'm a nicer enough? I have more equanimity tomorrow. I'm able to be present in the moment tomorrow, but I'm still the fish that I was yesterday. Well, I've thought about this for a long time, and I'll tell you what I think, and maybe we'll come to some kind of, I don't know, maybe we'll start a discussion. Hopefully we'll maybe figure some stuff out. But I think what Dogen, I want to bring up one of the ways that Domio has talked about practice. And a lot of what she, kind of a lens through which you can see practice are these things that she calls samadhi power and karma relationship. And essentially, karma relationship is about understanding the way that your personal karma affects you in your daily life, the way that you respond to things, certain situations. A lot of that is bundled in your own particular package of karma. And karma relationship is this really tricky thing. I think Kyogen was the one who coined the term karma relationship, but it's a really good phrase because it kind of helps us see the way that we want to understand how our karma can affect certain situations. We're going to get into, I'm going to do my other old story that has stuck into my head for a very long time. And it's a koan, and it's called Hyakujo's Fox or Baijiun's Fox. And there's a bunch of ins and outs in it, and it's very strange, and I don't want to get into the whole koan, but essentially the koan is centered around this question of, is an enlightened person bound by cause and effect? Is an enlightened person bound by karma? And so the monk asks the teacher, and the teacher gives the answer. So the monk asks, "Master, is the enlightened person bound by karma or not?" And the master says, "And the enlightened person is not deceived by karma." So whether or not we're subject to karma, whether or not we are subject to cause and effect, to our sort of like reactions that are based on our conditioning, is not really asking the right question. What we're trying to do through practice is to understand our relationship to karma. And I think what that means is we're trying to understand our own reactions in our day-to-day world. Why did I get angry? Why did I get frustrated? And if we can truly see that for what it is, it becomes easier to let go. And I think what Dogen is really pointing us towards is that we tend to make the mistake of identifying with our own karma and identifying it with ourselves. This is my anger. This is my frustration. This is my disappointment. This is my greed. This is my envy. Those things are mine and they are part of me. And through practice, we can see that those are just the stains of karma. Those are the marks of karma. And to claim those as yours is to make the mistake of thinking that you have to transform into something else. All we have to do is recognize that this is not what we are. The little circle that we draw around and say, everything inside of the circle is me. Your karma is not in that. And so in that sense, if we can understand our relationship to our karma, and if we can understand that that's not us, that's not who we are, it becomes easier to drop away. I mean, I think back on the transformations that I've made through practice, and all of them have been on some level, like remarkably easy. I just, if I can see my actions in a particular way, they just almost drop off of their own accord. I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to be that type of person. And then as if by magic, it slowly drifts away. It becomes easier day by day with practice. And I think that's what Dogen is telling us about transformations. I think what he's trying to say is that you, as the fish that you are today, through practice, through genuine practice with our Sangha, you have already made the transformation you need. And that all of the parts of you that you think you need to change and you think that need to be different, those aren't what you are. And if you can sort of drop those away through practice, then you will see that you are the fish. You already are the dragon. You are at the dragon gate. Here in practice, you already are that thing that you wanted to be, because you've dropped off all of this stuff. I don't know. That was about, it's about 3 months worth of kicking this around in my head. That's where I'm at right now. Honestly, I've been through so many iterations of trying to make sense of this, and then like a week later, I'll discard it as nonsense. I don't know if this sounded like nonsense. I don't know. I would like us to kind of maybe like engage in a discussion. One thing that I will tell you about me, I would love, if you want to ask me some very difficult questions, I can take it. I will not be like, I would rather be embarrassed and figure something out than everybody be polite and like, I miss it. So hard questions, easy questions, thoughts, comments, whatever. Let's go for it. Hi, in the Nerd Zendo.
I think it would be helpful if we could just talk about the cultural importance of the dragon in Chinese folklore.
Sure. I'm sorry?
Can anyone do that here?
Can you?
You can't ask that question without answering it.
No, I can't. I mean, I know it's a mystical, powerful.
I have the same question. I mean, what is the significance beast of a dragon? What is the dragon?
Well,
mean?
They are extremely important, right, in Chinese culture as an elevated sort of spiritual being. And if someone else wants to do a better mark, you look like you know something.
I just have like a loose grab bag of dim memories that dragons are considered to be very wise, yeah, to be sort of protector figures. But beyond that, I don't have anything. Okay. I'm going to the Google.
All right.
Yeah, that's good. Get Google on the microphone.
Thank you,
Judith. Hey, Junior, go ahead.
I'm waiting on Mark. Oh, were you looking up or not?
The top answer is the dragon is believed by the Chinese to present power and valiancy, excellence and determination, dignity and divinity.
So I just saw something too that
to overcome obstacles and see success.
This one suggests that in Zen literature, it's a symbol of enlightenment and also a symbol of ourselves. Which I think is interesting. Anyway, that's what Google said with dragons and Zen.
So that was very interesting. Thank you both, especially what Tyler just said. I was going to take a little bit of a different tack. This thing about owning our karma or not. I enjoy every Sunday morning the Gatha of Atonement, because in saying that three times, just to say it for those who don't know, all harmful karma, help me.
All ever committed by me.
Since of old, born of my body, mouth, and thought, now I fully avow. And I say that three times. That to me is the buck stops here. I have to let go of that now. I can't go forward anymore. I got to drop the baggage. And so every week, once a week, I start the week by making an attempt to let go of that. The other thing that came up for me as you were talking, you know, when I have, particularly if I'm going to give a talk on it, but even if I just want to think about it a lot, I will go to as many different translations as I can find, because who knows which one is really what Dogen said. I had even picked up Mark Warner lately, Brad Warner, excuse me. And for those who don't know, he is a bona fide Zen priest and teacher, but also has a lot of form in his background and is a guitar player in a punk rock band.
He's a bass player.
That's a guitar.
That makes him even.
But my point is, he has a great little essay on how difficult it is to understand what Dogen is saying. And this translator will say this, and that translator will say that. And here's why it's so difficult, because this is really Chinese, not Japanese, but he's writing in Chinese, but he's talking to Japanese people, and on and on and on. And how you really need to be so understanding in both languages in medieval era of each language. So, I really like to get all the different perspectives. And his perspective, he doesn't translate. He
summarizes. He writes them.
Yeah, but it's another word for summarize. But anyway, he interprets what he understands the teaching to be. So that's, I find that helpful. And I find looking at other people's interpretations of it to be helpful. It sort of enriches my own understanding. But the last thing, and I think probably the most important thing that I have to say related to your talk is, if I have become nicer, if I have become more loving and kind to myself, if I have become less critical, and in so doing become more happy, who's to say that that wasn't there to begin with? By letting go of criticism, by letting go of fears of myself, criticism of myself, and the whole and all that karmic related stuff, baggage. I mean, isn't that the real me anyway? And in saying that, have I transformed or have I not? Have I not just become who I really am? It's a thought.
Yeah, Denny.
First of all, I'm sorry. I still can't figure out kind of raise my hand through reactions. But, and I'm pretty new to this group, maybe two going on 3 weeks. So I'm a little shy about it. I'll own that. But I can really relate to what you said, Mick. And I remember not long ago reading that Dogen said, as soon as a person begins to practice, they are already enlightened. And intention, I've come to find, is very important in Zen. And I've experienced too, through the years of my practice, that it's almost as though, I mean, we're all supposed to have Buddha nature at birth. And I feel as though, and I've been practicing for about 20 years, that through time, it's like I've started shedding layers of an onion. It's like I'm an onion of these layers of conditioning that began when I was an infant, through my family, my experiences, all the relationships that I have learned from, but all the fears, all the ways I've learned to protect myself and make excuses for myself, those are slowly peeling away, because the kindness, as I'm sorry, I'm not sure of your name, but the woman who just said it was already there. All of those qualities have just been, all those naturally occurring qualities have just been slowly covered by conditioning. So I just wanted to offer that up as experience, personal experience.
Thank you. Dave, you're sitting in the chair. You ready?
I am waiting my turn. I just wanted to add that when you were talking about the Dragon Gate, I couldn't help but think about stories of awakening that you read in all of the things that we read. And you talk about crossing a bridge, or hearing a pebble hit a piece of bamboo, or having the bottom drop out of a bucket. I mean, we're at the Dragon Gate continuously, right? Like it is where you are. When you read these stories, you don't hear about people like diligently sitting zazen and then by force of effort, like coming to some awakening. It's just that place where they are at that time. So that's all.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah, come on up, Richardson.
Yeah, I wanted to say one thing about that whole story of the Dragon Gate, because there was a really popular video game that used that as a basis for two of its characters that were, one of the non-evolutionary form was the most annoying character in the entire game. It was called Magikarp. And you would catch this fish Pokemon, and all it could do was this move called Splash. And so literally the only way for you to give this Pokemon experience was to either get the item that gave all your Pokemon experience. But before that, there was a part of the game where you would have your lead Pokemon come out, and then you could withdraw them and put another Pokemon out to finish the battle, and then they would get partial experience. So literally the only way you could evolve this stupid fish Magikarp into the Gyarados dragon, which was one of the most powerful characters in the game, was literally to do nothing and withdraw it from battle frustratingly over and over again, because if you tried to make it do something, it would literally say Magikarp used Splash, it was not effective.
That's wonderful.
Hilarious.
Anybody else? We might have time for one more. Okay, well, it is that time. It is midnight Eastern, which means it's time to retire. I'll say our closing verse. We dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.
That went fast.
Thank you, man.
Thanks, everybody.
It's great.
Bye-bye. Good night.
Thanks, Mick.